At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Look at Maxime. He knows he's done it, Kaya.
That is tension leaving Maxime's body right now.
He is the winner. Maxime Vachier-Lagrave, the Frenchman. He wins the AI Cup. He banks the ticket to Toronto. He is going to the Tour Finals. He does the impossible. He beats Magnus Carlsen in two matches.
Roi des quatre, il avance son roi à fou F1, il bloque tout. Et c'est roi C7 et c'est deux dames. Et c'est deux dames. Abandonne. Lâche ça. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go, Maxime. Let's go, le Punto. Ça dégage. Ça dégage maintenant.
All right, special podcast episode from Toronto, Canada. It's the end of the Champions Chess Tour. Unfortunately, both of you are eliminated, but that does allow us to have a very special guest with us today. We have the Frenchman with three names, Maxime Vachier-Lagrave, joining us. Maxime, welcome to the podcast.
Nice to be here.
Pleasure to have you on the podcast.
I know I have good company on that seat.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yes, we've had some interesting names for sure, but obviously you're one of, I think, the seventh highest rated player in history, if I'm not mistaken. A very rarefied 2800 club,
yeah,
for sure. So it's always a pleasure.
But it's getting tougher now to get in there.
It's definitely tougher right now, but welcome to the show. Tell us a bit about this tournament. Let's start with that. Champions Chess Tour just finished. Well, actually, the semifinals just finished. The finals start today. Tell us a bit about your experience.
I mean, the experience in itself was very nice. My play was nothing short of horrifying. I've had problems with consistency since COVID in terms of playing well and sometimes very well in tournaments, actually winning a few events. I think I win at the same weight events compared to before COVID. But when I do badly, I don't do average or mediocre. I can do shameful. And this time was shameful. And the result in itself, it can happen. It was a lot of Armageddon losses. But the way it happened, the way some of my games went, the blunders I was making, the oversights, it was really not up to my standards.
I'm actually kind of curious about your opinion, both of your opinions, on the format. Let's start with you, Fabi.
We were asked this yesterday together, by Eric Altebest.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just curious. Because I guess they're planning to change, most likely change something next year. Well, they're going to change the preliminary, but maybe also the final stuff.
It could be. And I've actually been asked the same question by Michael today. I think the format is nice. It's nice to have a round robin. It's nice to have matches because then you don't have draws. So this part is good. The survival stage I like. And I think every tournament should end with a playoff. It might be a controversial take, but for instance, for World Rapid and Blitz, I would very much like to see top four go to semi-final finals. I think that would be a great addition. So with that in mind, I think the format in itself is great. I do think it was a little bit exhausting for the players because there were so many games. We counted that you could play up to 53 games. Yeah, in a matter of 8 days. So
it's a lot of games. Yeah,
rapid games.
They're a lot of games. Yeah.
So we were thinking with Fabi that maybe 15 minutes is too slow for such an amount of games. So maybe 10, or Michael suggested maybe today 12 minutes, something like this could...
And also the Armageddon could go to 10.
Yeah, yeah, 10 Armageddon. Rather than 15 every days. Game would go to 10 yeah. basis time. And I think it would work quite well because also, like, I know there were pauses during podcasts that were sometimes a bit long, especially for the audience. So, you know, at the same time, we needed rest between games because it was really, otherwise it would have been too intense. But I do think that chess should tend to be more spectacular, more exhausting for the players, not be like one classical game a day, which is exhausting in itself because, okay, you have all the preparation beforehand, but like we cannot complain because the classical games, of course, if you were playing 6 to 7 hour game every day, it would be too much. But generally, like average is 4 hours, and some of the games just exhaust themselves after 1.5, 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. And some games are quick draws in classical, right? We saw that in the Sinkfield Cup. Yeah, exactly, some games are just quick draws. But so you mentioned Michael. That's Michael Brancato.
Yes.
Like for our viewers who don't know, because I was part of watching the Smash, Super Smash scene. So I knew about him, but I didn't know his real name. Mm. There was this player, Nintendude. Mm-hmm. And so I was watching him, and then a few years ago, I actually met him. And that's the reason why the double elimination format was introduced, because that's he was like part of the organization, and the double elimination has always been the standard in Smash tournaments. Mm-hmm. And now they're branching out, so now we have this sort of group stage, and which I think is interesting as well. Like you mentioned the four-player, let's say, final. I think there is one issue with that. Like, if we go back to 2019, where you played, you beat Magnus in the Grand Chess Tour.
Yeah.
If you look at Magnus's tour points before the four-player final, it was very dominant. He was winning most of the events.
Yeah, that's true.
And then he doesn't win the whole thing because... Well, because he lost you, and then...
That's true, but for instance, in basketball, you had the Warriors in 2016 going crazy, 73-9, sorry. And, like, best season ever, and they lose in the final to the Cavs. I mean, nobody complained about that. Also, I think in general, because it would mean that... Like, I don't know how to implement it, because... schedule is already very packed as it is, but like every round robin event would be like this, and like, but of course it has an issue inherent with round robins that then you're going to play to secure one of the top four spots by the end of the tournament. So like, there are details to be ironed out. Here it works very well because there are no draws basically in the round robin stage, so maybe like, if we want to look at the future, maybe that's what we're going to have to do, like to find a way to get rid of draws and so on.
Yeah, like most likely we can't find a perfectly fair system.
For sure not, yeah.
But like, for example, in this tour, Magnus again got like 625 points and the next was like 325 or something. And like, imagine if I had won 2 Armageddon games instead of losing them, he would be knocked out and it wouldn't... Most people would think this doesn't seem very fair. Like, he just managed to lose. Like, he did everything better, and then he lost 2 Armageddon games. And then, I understand that.
It's true, but it's part of the uncertainty of,
exactly,
of sports. And also, like, it's not like Magnus hasn't been on the other side of this. Like, sometimes it would just be very clutch.
Yeah.
At the right moment.
So. I mean, the underdog has to have a chance to win as well. Even as, and you made a very good point with the Warriors being 70, completely dominant in the regular play.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's not the only example. It's just one example that
but
came
it's a good
to my
one,
mind.
Right? Because then they got to the finals. They were the clear favorites, and then they lost. Right? So it can happen, and it should happen. It just adds to the excitement of sports in general, and we should have that as in chess as well. And I really like the part of the format where everybody's fighting for something, even until the last moment. Like, even Hikaru.
Exactly,
he was
yeah.
one out of...
Six,
yeah. right? And
yes.
then he still had a great chance.
So chance,
he actually
yeah.
made it to the survival.
He was even, let's say, a favorite at some point to get to the semifinal.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Because he's objectively, I mean, it's very close with Norderbeck. Norderbeck is super strong, but we would still probably give Hikaru the statistical edge if we had to, right?
For sure, yeah. Maybe not on current form at this tournament, but still.
In general.
And this could be an anomaly, right? Because, okay, let's say Lazovic was expected to score somewhere around there, but Alireza having 1 out of 6 was kind of an anomaly, right, going into the final
round. It was an anomaly, but the field was very strong. So, like, of course, you have... No, Alireza was 2 out of 6
but
with
he was
me.
Magnus.
Yeah. With me and Dikau, I mean, we were not really expected to be there. But at the same time, the field was very tough. So, like, it can happen.
I mean, someone really strong had to go out at the earliest stage.
Yes.
Like, okay, everyone expected Dennis to go out at the earliest stage.
Yeah.
With all due respect to him, but still, people kind of expected it. But someone else who was, like, a top
Yeah, and he put up great fights, but still, yeah. It
and
was
he didn't
expected.
Yeah, he didn't play badly at all. He won a match. He was close in several matches.
Yeah.
But yeah, someone who's a top tier grandmaster had to go out. Yes. There was no way around that.
Yeah, but there was a fight.
Like even if people were thinking maybe Nodibek was a favorite to go out, I mean he's still super super strong. Yeah. He's world rapid champion.
27-30 or close, whatever. 27-20
Ridiculous, ridiculous strength. Yeah, and actually I thought going into the semis that he would be a favorite against Wesley. I wasn't sure if Wesley made the right decision not to choose you because, I mean, you guys are very, very closely matched and you played a pretty close match against Nodirbek as well.
Well, in hindsight, Wesley was absolutely right with his
choice. Yeah, it was, of course, of course. I mean, given the form as well, I would say that it was the wise decision. But again, Nodirbek is no pushover.
We were actually talking about this before, also about Wesley specifically, because Wesley has a bad record against Maxime.
Yeah.
So, like, if Maxime had made it to the choice, to the semis,
good question,
who would have Wesley picked, me or Maxime? Because he's also struggled against me recently. And I think Wesley is one of those players who he really wants to feel good against who he's playing.
That's true.
Then he can turn it up very, very high. But if not, then he can actually
Maybe he would have chosen me because specifically I turned around the match in the round robin stage, maybe.
Ah, okay, yeah. Maybe some recent emotions could play into that. Yeah, that's true.
No, recent emotions for sure. No, that's the thing. I mean, it's a discussion always, and there's always choices, and, you know, the audience can also get involved and make predictions, like who's going to choose who and things of that nature. There's always something to fight for, and there's always a discussion, which I
think
is
very what
important.
I liked the most about this format.
Yeah.
Like, yesterday also was great to watch, like, you know, you always have game with sporting value, and you see Wesley going 2-0. He has white the next game. He still loses because, well, games are very short, so mistakes and nerves can get the better of you. We saw really a lot of weight losses after going 1-0. I had one. I think Alireza had one or even maybe two.
I definitely had one. Did I have more than one? I don't think so. I definitely lost with black on demand.
But you lost with white.
Against Magnus.
Yes.
But did I have more? I can't think of another example. Yeah.
No.
Not on demand.
So that's at least 4, maybe more. Probably
more, yeah.
Actually, let's speak about the Armageddon, because I think this is another important discussion.
Yes.
It's so interesting to see the styles of choices as well. I think Magnus went very low against you, then he didn't, for the second Armageddon, didn't go too low against you, and you actually went lower in the second Armageddon. Why did you do that? I felt like, given the match situation, that you would want to have white once again.
You know, I wasn't sure because I thought maybe I was starting to exhaust my opening ideas a bit.
Okay.
And yeah, I wasn't sure what he would go for. He was starting to get a bit more solid with his openings, like he was starting to actually play his main stuff. So going for e45, probably to get a marshal. So I wasn't thinking that I would be super confident to outplay him in the marshal or anti-marshal.
But you won 2 games with white, right?
I won.
Did you win 2 games?
No.
You drew the first 2 games and then you won with white.
Well, yeah, I was winning in 2 games in the second match.
Yes, second match.
Yeah. No, in the same line. I mean, I played him twice in the same line. It was a very successful choice for me. But yeah, Armageddon is tough. I thought that I would be okay with black. Like, I didn't want to get black with, like, very little time, but I thought...
I think you were okay, just, like, at some point, probably exhaustion, brain freeze, I don't know.
Yeah, I rushed some decisions and was also not seeing things. So it was just my form. Like, the opening was good at my form in that game. Actually, both Armageddon games, my form was not there.
Yeah.
But again, it's about the choices of how many minutes would you, what would you say is the sweet spot in terms of?
I mean, in general, I think pretty much everyone agrees within 9 to 10 minutes, like this was most of the bids. But first of all, well, I mean, for me, it was not very successful in Nomageddons. Clearly, there's something I hadn't worked on, like how to play with time advantage, and it's becoming a bit integrant, or time disadvantage if we're back. And so, you know, because for a while it was just a random thing that was happening, and like it very rarely had sporting incidents, although once it did have a lot for me in this World Cup semifinals. But
was this against Levon?
Yeah. But first of all, it was 5-4, and by this point, every bets are off. Like it's 3 weeks competition already. It's 6 or 7 hours of the tiebreak. I mean,
this is just pure nerves and tiredness at this point.
I would say even pure luck, basically. Like it just luck, because I had a great position. Comes down to one move. It's not even nerves at this point. Like you're in automatic mode. But here it's becoming integrant. So we need to devise a strategy and how to play in this format, like to take it more seriously than before. At least that's what I think
would
I should do.
Would you implement that in your training, like playing with time advantage? I think we did that at some point in one of the training camps. I think Norway was coming along, and
yeah, we did.
We were looking at some stuff and playing like 10 against 7 minutes.
Yeah, I don't think you can really replicate it because it's also so much nerves.
Yeah,
and when you don't have the nerves, it's just it's like a completely move.
Yeah, but I don't think it's only about the nerves. I think I was playing way too fast in these Armageddon games.
But do you think this is also a product of nerves, perhaps?
I mean, it's product of my play. In general, I play very fast. Should it be in classical, in rapid? I mean, it has evolved. At some point, it was really even more obvious. Not to the extent of, say, Jan in classical, who can be crazy, but it was still pretty obvious that I would generally go to time control with at least 15, 20 minutes left, which is kind of insane.
When you yeah, that's quite a lot. Mm. Yeah. I very rarely achieve that.
Yeah. And then there's Sasha, who always end up in type trouble.
Would you say that's a product of your confidence?
That's a product of my playing strategy, basically. So, like, I look forward to having the time advantage. I think it's a good thing to have. And as long as it's not at all costs, at the cost of overlooking things in the positions, which did happen to me sometimes, did happen to Jan even more frequently, because he was doing it even a bit more extremely. Like, he came down, like, recently, but, like...
You had a famous game against him.
Yeah.
Where, by like move 10 with white, he had lost a piece.
I mean, it's maybe move 15.
In classical?
Yeah, in classical.
In single cup?
In single cup.
And like,
he was playing his preparation, and, you know, it just ends by forcing a draw. At some point, he plays one very random move, but this one just loses by force. Like, it's not a piece, but it's a huge pawn, let's say.
Very interesting, very interesting.
And he had 1 hour 30 on the clock. And I remember as I played my move, I see him looking over in the restroom, I mean, where you have the screens. And he just is shocked and stays there for like 5 to 10 minutes. I don't know if you remember that.
I just remember him at the board laughing.
Yeah, yeah. Then he comes back to the board, he laughs. I was expecting him to resign, but he played on.
Actually, you have like some tremendous score against him, right? Like some very dominant.
7-1, something like that.
7-1, yeah, very dominant. Like I noticed that you have quite dominant scores against some players. Well, for me, it's like pretty uniform. I'd have pretty close scores. Obviously, against Magnus, not a good score, but against everyone else, like pretty close scores. But it's who else? Do you? Also Wesley, right? You have a very good score.
Wesley and Dink, to some extent.
As well, yeah.
Yeah, and I have very bad records against some players. Like Magnus is one. It's not that shameful lately, because also like in Rapid and Blitz, it's a bit closer, but I think it's 9-2 in Classical. I'm not sure. it's not great, but...
Yeah, nobody has a good score against him. Well, I guess maybe Fishy, but based on like a million years ago. Or Peter, also based on a million years ago. But yeah, like you tend to have some streaky results against certain players.
Yes, that's true. Like I know against Hikaru, I've done 0-5 or something.
You haven't beaten Hikaru in Classical?
No.
It's about time.
How?
Although he got so much more solid now.
Yeah.
Much harder these days.
Now he's difficult. Yeah. Speaking of you know, the shorter time formats, let's stay on that subject a little bit. You are a world champion, 2021. Tell us a bit about that moment. Obviously, a world championship title is a big deal.
It was really a big deal. I probably didn't expect it to be such a big deal. Also, because in 2015, I had a very big opportunity already to win the title. I was like 1.5 points ahead with 4 games to go. I lost 2 games in a row and ended up 0.5 point short. And well, that left me a very bitter taste, aftertaste. But yeah, then also after the first day of Blitz, I had lost 2 games in a row at some point, and I was like, middle of the chasing pack, but nothing huge. I had these huge second days and the tie breaks. Well, then again, like it's something a bit crazy when you think about it, that after all these years, after all these times where we've had tie break issues, that we still go down to this three players being tied, and you have a tie breaks for 2 players only. You have Ali Reza being left out.
Mm.
I mean, and it was not the first occurrence of this.
I remember this.
Yeah. Yeah, because you were on the wrong side of this in the rapid. Yeah.
I was on the wrong side in the rapid. It was a 4-way tie. Magnus was also on the wrong side.
Yeah.
And Noderbeck and Nepo
played the tie break match. So, like, this tie break issue has been going on for 5 to 10 years. So
what's the best solution for this?
It's very hard to say. Like, especially 3 players tie break is not so easy. 4 players is easy. Like, the best I can think of is one of the reasons I want to go playoffs, like four players go to playoff, because, well, then, of course, you still have to...
Incentivize being in two, let's say.
No, also you have to figure out a way to determine the third and fourth spot, because sometimes there will be a massive tie.
Yeah, imagine 3 people on like...
But what I mean is you get one special day to figure all this out, because especially both in Rapid and Blitz, it should be possible to devise a system where, you know, you create some knockout matches for players tied, especially... Okay,
but then you'll have like multiple players. Like imagine there's 3 players on 9.5 in Rapid, and then there's like 8 players on 9 points.
Yeah.
Well, then 8 players on 9 points will play a knockout to determine the spot.
And then another knockout with 4 players?
It's tough, but...
But this...
especially in Rapid, it's really tough.
Isn't there something better than this?
There should be. Like, it's just pretty random, and I haven't like thought the details too much at this point.
Playing, let's say, an extra day?
Extra day would be necessary, for sure.
Extra day and just, like, take the top, I don't know, 12, let's say, no matter what.
But again, like, you're going to have this
we're
tie.
We're going to choose like, some tie.
What
breaks.
About 13 through 16?
You can decide to say top 8, and if you... And you do it very randomly, like you use good old tie breaks, because if you finish shared 8th, it's not the same as if you finish shared 1st at the same time. Like, you're left out, but it's...
But if this eighth place ends up winning the whole thing, then it does start to feel that way, right?
Yeah, but then again, it's the same in like in every sport. Like you have the regular season, and then at the end of the day, you can be tied for some spot, and you don't get in.
Mm-hmm. I still rather do top 4, because at least that feels a bit less random than top 8. And because top 8, you're going to have some tie. People are going to be left out based on random tie breaks. Top 4, it's less likely that this will happen.
Yeah. But it's not because it's less likely that it won't happen. So,
so we got lost in the
yeah, we're getting a bit again. Lost in this discussion. But I think it's a very interesting one because I do think it's part of the future of chess. I mean, round robins or like Swiss tournaments are very nice, but I think it's just extra sweet to have this semi-final and finals at the end. And also, like, okay, in Blitz it cannot happen, but in Rapid you can easily imagine a scenario where five players share the first place at the end. And then to have an inclusive tiebreaks of all five players is borderline impossible if it's at the end of a day of
long. You need another round robin. And then to
yeah, but remember that in the Rapid World Championship, we play maybe only five games is absolutely insane. But four games, it's like it lasts at least 5 hours.
You need another day. There's no
yeah,
other way.
Yeah, you need another day.
So, keeping on this discussion a bit. Do you think that classical chess is going to be phased out somewhat or even completely at some point?
I do think so. I mean, to some extent. I do like Magnus' suggestion of two games a day.
Like 45 minutes or something like that, yeah?
Like, I thought about it. 45 plus 30 cannot work because you easily have games that last 120 moves. 120 moves, so that's 2 extra hours.
Those are anomalies, like 120 move games are anomalies.
Yeah, but that's 2 extra hours. So that's like a game that lasts 3 hours and 30 minutes. And remember, like 45 plus 30, it's a very fast time control. So then this rook and bishop against rook, you can get there, you will play it out for sure. Cause
so make it 45 plus 15.
Something like that. Or 1 hour and 10 seconds, something like this. It's true that 10 or 15 seconds is not a lot.
Because my worry is, like, I like to lower the time control but keep the increment, because the increment ensures that people don't get screwed up in completely drawn-in games. Or just because this I feel
so 15 seconds is not enough, for instance.
Like, what because about 30 plus 30?
30 plus 30? Yeah, but again, if you're one game lasts 120 moves, and like in a round robin, it's unlikely, but like in an open, it's extremely likely, and that's already a 3 hours game.
But this is so you'll have 2 3-hour games. Like this is still a normal day at the office.
Could be.
I mean, we very often play 6 hour games.
It works.
Go that long.
No, it works. I guess.
I guess you have a break in between that does add, but I've very often played six and a half.
No,
7 hour
it's
games,
true. It could work. Like. And again, I think it's not about the exact details, but the idea of having you have one white, one black. I don't think you do tiebreaks after that, but you can add it, like if you don't want the players to have a draw between each other. But then I don't like it so much because then it's an Armageddon with like 30 or 45 minutes best time. It's a bit strange for classical.
Yeah, I don't like these super long Armageddons.
So you can just decide to do. To keep draws for that for now. And I think you get a lot more action. I think the opening theory is still very dominant, but at least you can come back and you can take more risk.
No, also, it's not really dominant. Like I'm thinking about like during this event, I really did not prepare.
Yeah.
Just like very general, like deciding my opening. I mean, general opening knowledge is very important.
Of course.
But like deep preparation almost never happens.
No, deep preparation doesn't. And what I mean, opening preparation is still very important, but you can turn things around, and more importantly, you can take risk in your opening choices. Whereas in classical, it's much more difficult, like in the six-hour games, because if you take a risk, you can just get punished very blatantly.
Yeah, remember, I mean, even very slight changes make a huge impact. At the American Cup, you just simply don't have the second time control. And a lot of players were, especially Naka, for example, he was playing the Kalashnikov, taking a lot of risks.
He was doing this generally also at Norway Chess. I think he just prepared it.
In Grand Swiss, he did, against Eric Gaze in the last round, I think.
Yes. But again, it does feel like, even with very, very slight, minute details being changed, a lot of players will consider taking more risks, for sure. So But again, let's go back to your World Championship title. How did life change for you at that point in time? Because you said it was a big deal.
It was,
you did not expect it to be such a big deal.
Yeah, yeah, we got lost in thought. But it was really a big deal. Yeah, I mean, it was on major media outlets. We got with Ali Reza to meet the Prime Minister of France, for instance.
Ali Reza was already
federations. Oh, for a long time. Yeah, it was even because he switched federations, I think, even before he got naturalized as a French citizen. But that was July of 2021. He had played for us brilliantly in the European Team Championship.
Yeah, where he got 2800.
That's where,
yeah. And that tiebreak match I had with Jan Christoph was also extremely interesting. And like, for one of the first time in my life, I mean, not the only one, of course, but I had the feeling that nothing could disturb me during gameplay. And like, there were like quite a lot of spectators, but I was not noticing them. And only at the end, when there was the applause.
You were kind of in the zone, in the flow.
Yeah, I was in the flow. And I think you can notice it from the footage.
Yes, yes. That's actually one thing that I've noticed with you. Even this tournament against Hikaru, you always seem very much focused on the game itself. Like, you know, you can spot this type of details in all the players that at some point maybe they miss something, or at some point they get distracted by something. You always seems to be, like, you know, only focused on
the game. Not always the case. And also sometimes it's just an impression I leave. I tend to keep a very good poker face at the chessboard in general. Like, I reviewed the footage where, like, for instance, the Armageddon game against Wesley, where he was like debating, maybe a bit trolling over where to put his queen. Sometimes it could be just a one move blunder. And I remained completely like unfazed. Yeah.
I'm terrible at this. Like, if my opponent's about to make a blunder, I have very, in blitz, like, very often just giving it away.
I'm terrible at this everywhere else. Like, in poker, I'm absolutely terrible at keeping a poker face, but in chess, it works out. Like, unless I'm completely winning or completely lost.
The worst poker face is Hikaru.
No, but the thing is, like, Hikaru, I don't know how much is acting. Okay, he definitely...
He's a showman, also. Yeah,
well, yeah, but it dates from well before his streaming days, like back in 2009, 2010. He was already doing this. So I think it's part of his character. But one of his abilities is to go through that moment of like 3-5 minutes of pure despair, and then come back and actually refocus, which is not so easy.
Yeah, he does some go through despair. I think it's maybe a bit distracting. Like, I was really trying not to get distracted when this Armageddon game. Luckily, I didn't even have to like think about the position. It was so winning. But
yeah,
but he was really like just almost throwing himself in the chair.
And yeah, like pure laughing and just yeah.
I remember that game against West against Nodibek that we were watching on the footage, and Hikaru was like, not knowing what to do.
Well, I think that's, I think that's genuine. That's he has these moments of panic.
Yeah.
Because he's trying to like search for any chance, but sometimes there is no chance.
Yeah.
I have to say, Magnus curses in Norwegian.
He does.
Yes.
Okay. And I've started to notice it a lot more recently. Okay, this match, like at least 5 games, I noticed it.
Wow.
Usually when it's completely hopeless. When there's still some hope, he's like focused, but... he was like cursing in that fourth game.
Fear is very
fear.
Yeah, it's a very popular word for him.
I don't even like hear the words that he said.
Yeah, yeah. No, because he did that in 2015 in this World Bridge Championship.
Against you, yeah?
Not against me, against Shuki. Yeah, but yeah. I was playing and I heard it and it was a bit, this time I didn't remain unfazed.
I mean, somehow the emotions are much more pronounced, in rapid and blitz games than in classical, obviously.
It's true.
I don't know, everything goes by so much faster. There's so much more tension in those very
There's no time like to react. So like, because probably in classical, you would just end up calling the arbiter. Like after, maybe not the first time, but second or third time, I feel like I would just...
I mean, if I'm not in time trouble and it's completely winning, I'll just like get up and go, like, you can suffer if you want.
Yeah, but imagine, because you're the direct competitor, but if like other players might get bothered
That's
by
true.
This.
The worst I've seen for that was Wesley and Lanier in 2017. They were playing a match and like they just kept escalating, banging the clock. Like,
okay. I remember at some point Wesley was just like both hands on each side of the table and just banging the clock.
Yeah,
and I think it was just nerves. Like there's no blame on him, but it was really distracting.
Well, one of them bled on the clock. Like there was this famous photo of having blood on the clock. I don't know. Who
oh
it was,
yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
One of them bled on the clock.
It was like impossible to concentrate.
Yeah,
it was like the most intensive banging for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, Wesley. I complained about Wesley at Arbiter once because I didn't know him. He was like. It was my time trouble. He has a minute, and he's banging the clock. And I'm sure it's nerves or whatever, but still, it's like, it's my time trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, I have 5 seconds, you have a minute. So you just can't do this. Yeah.
It's true.
Pretty much against the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, people definitely get their emotions up in this fast, which I understand. I also...
Yeah, also, I know that's because in some events, we had heart rate monitors, and Wesley's... heart rate goes through the roof, even in classical game, like 150, 160.
Well, you played the Armageddon, right? Armageddon
series.
I was watching this, which is very entertaining. And I noticed the heart rates of all the players. So I can tell you who is staying more or less low heart rate and who is going crazy.
Wes, Shanklin?
Shanky is he's okay.
Stable, right?
He's more or less around 100.
Richie, surprisingly, was going very high.
He's like 180. Like,
yeah.
It's like running,
but,
sprinting.
No surprise that Mickey was like...
Yeah, very calm.
Yeah.
And...
Mickey Adams, right?
Mickey was good. Yeah, Mickey Adams? Mickey
Adams. Yeah. I was going 110, 120, if I remember.
You were stable, yeah? More or less normal.
That's very good. Yeah.
I think, yeah, Shanklin was one of the best. I think Andrew Tang was normal, fine. He was doing fine. Yeah, the most notable were Wesley and Richie just going like through the roof, 160, 170 in critical.
Especially Richie, I was surprised because Wesley, we know about his nerves sometimes, especially in rapid time controls. Richie just seems unbothered in general.
He gets nervous during games. I can tell.
It's true.
Yeah.
Well,
also,
I mean,
it might be about physical shape. And I don't know how much
is I don't think this is down to physical shape. I think this is down to... to nerves and maybe sometimes, I wouldn't say motivation, but like at least getting this sense of importance to the game. Like, because I felt like, for instance, my heart rate in some of the games, for instance, my Armageddon game with Wesley, was going much higher than I didn't have a heart rate monitor to confirm, but I'm pretty sure I was going 130, 140 there.
Yeah, this makes sense. Like, if you're attacked by a wild animal, you're going to sense the urgency.
Yes, yes, you will.
If you're going to, if you really care about the game, then you're going to sense the urgency.
Yeah,
if you
because
don't care so much,
Armageddon was a bit special because we were playing 20 minutes a day.
Yeah.
So, you, I mean, at least I was not like entering with the sense of urgency. I was like, you know, let's play some games of chess. It is quite important. It is quite a lot of money we're playing for. But you don't have the build-up. You don't have the excitement going in.
Yeah. I enjoyed watching this format, but it was short. It was just too short.
It was a bit too short, but it was very nice, of course, for the players. Like, but, yeah, I do think it's not intense enough for a sporting event. Like, maybe this Champion Chess 2 Finals was a bit too intense, but I'd rather have it too intense than not intense enough.
Well, it's all about the length of the broadcast, and I think this is probably what they wanted with that shorter format. It's like 2 hours of play, right?
Yeah, of course.
Which is a normal game of whatever, like basketball.
No,
football.
I do think short format is the way to go, and that's also one of the reasons I do think that classical games should be divided into
5, 6 hours, 7 hours of play.
That's
just impossible to put on TV.
Like,
yeah, it's
I mean, the only exception I know to that was Game 6.
In general, the World Championship will get the numbers, but yeah, Game 6.
No, but
especially.
It gets the numbers, but people are not gonna be watching for the whole 6 hours. Like, but at least because there was all that drama in Game 6, and it was the turning point of the match. people got there was some build up to it, like by the end of the game. But sometimes, yeah, it just 6 hours and
nothing.
Nothing really happens.
You made a good point that some at one moment you mentioned the 2015 World Rapid and Blitz, where you were ahead 1.5 points going into the Final Four, but you failed in that one. That leaves a scar in your memory. You said that. How do you block those type of thoughts, those type of emotions, as you go into those final few games in the 2021 World Championship? Were you thinking about that? Were those emotions and
so when it comes to Blitz, back? I'm a firm believer that you can't sense if you're going to have a good day or a bad day from the beginning of the day, from the first one or two games. So of course, it has its drawbacks. For instance, in the last Rapid and Blitz, where on the first day of Blitz, I was feeling very well, very confident. Then second day, already as the first two games were finished, I had lost both. I knew it was going to be a very tough day. I managed somehow to turn it around in game three against Ali Reza, but even that was a bit shaky. And then I collapsed, and probably my only decent game was against you.
But do you really think that you can feel... I never got the impression that I can feel if I'm going to have a good day or not. But I do feel like nervousness, definitely. If you're nervous, then it just completely ruins your play.
Yeah, I do know that in 2015 I was too nervous. And like, because I was already in the lead going in the second day, and I actually built up that lead, but I felt my play was not flowing as well. And so one moment, like I played with Vovk, with White, so which was like an easier game compared to everything I had on the day. So I felt I should push for a win. I had a better position, and then I pushed, overpushed. I made some mistakes and lost, and then I was already derailed. In Warsaw in 2021, on the contrary, the second day, first of all, we got this delay of 1 hour with COVID.
COVID tests were
positive, and some other players were tested.
But they had too many people were getting tested. The lines were too long, and they just had this massive delay, right?
Yeah, it was 1 hour. No, but not everyone was tested, and I think the numbers were 10% of the players were.
Were infected. This mandatory? These tests?
No.
I didn't get tested.
It's just by choice, yeah.
Yeah.
If you wanted,
I didn't get tested.
And
I did get tested. Yeah. These were two-hour lines,
I think,
in the cold. Right?
Yeah.
I think Vinat was posting at some point that he just...
I think the opponents of Ikaru and maybe one other player were tested. That's what was happening. Okay. So I was not tested.
I got tested after the event.
Yeah.
But I think this was probably to travel. I probably still needed to travel.
Yes, most likely.
Yeah, maybe
most
that.
Likely. Yeah.
So anyway, we had this huge one-hour delay. And then I got this very good fortune on the first game with Boris, where he flagged.
Boris Gelfand, yeah?
Yeah, Boris Gelfand. I was pawned down in a queen end game, fighting for my life, and he just flagged. And how it happened is he flags, and I'm pondering over my move because thinking, what should I do? It's not so easy to defend. And then I look at the clock because I'm I'm probably down to 1 or 2 seconds. And then I realize, someone is... has less time than that. And then my play started flowing. And so by the end of the day, I was just thinking about my play and feeling good about my play. Moves were flowing. I had also a bit of good fortune with Levan and with Magnus in the last round. It was all the complicated fights were going in my favor, which is not done to luck, because when I'm in good shape in Blitz, it tends to happen. But still, it was a very good feeling. And for instance, when Magnus is at his best level, it's also complicated fights tend to turn in his favor as well.
Yeah, some are almost a bit unbelievable, like this game against Richie that he played.
Oh,
this is, of course, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
You would think it's impossible, and no matter how good you are or how bad you are, there's nothing you can do in this situation.
Yeah.
But yeah, some...
No, but also in this Pitches Championship, I played with Magnus. Okay, one time I won, actually. And he was not in great shape. But I was in great shape. And he actually almost turned it around, in the bullet section. And then last year I played with him, and well, he was not as dominant as against you, but I was feeling I was playing very well, but I didn't convert a few chances, and I was done 4 or 5 games and never could recover. And like, I won maybe 3 games in that match, which is insane. Like, against Tikao, I would lose more badly, but I would win like at least 8 to 10 games total.
8 to 10 games, yeah? Because this is quite...
We don't make a lot of those with Tikao.
Oh, okay.
It's a bit chess.
Yeah, I mean, well, the thing is, like, for them, it's also such a huge advantage that they have the bullet format, because they can always rely on this to get back, even if the blitz isn't going too well.
It's true. Like, I feel like in top shape, okay, Magnus is a more comfortable opponent for me, but Ikao is just a little bit better everywhere, and in bullet a little more than a bit better and a bit faster. And, you know, because I see all these tricks, but Ikao sees them as well. So then this competitive advantage I have, probably even over Magnus, I don't have against Ikao. So that's why I've lost 4 times, in the speed chess championship.
Yeah, Ikao's speed chess championship run in general is like quite... Yeah, I mean, the bullet... I think if you took out the bullet, we would definitely see some different results.
For sure, yes.
But I understand having the bullet. I mean, it's not like a blitz championship. It's a speed chess championship, so it includes...
No, I mean, I don't mind the bullet section at all. It's just very tough competing against Ikao, but, you know, it just means we should get better at this.
Would you consider yourself, not necessarily, obviously you're good, but which one is better, your online speed chess or your over-the-board speed chess? Because
normally I would have said over the board, but recently I've been very consistency a lot over the board. So right now I would say online.
You feel pretty good about your online, yeah?
I mean, it's the weirdest thing. I won 5 title Tuesday this year.
That's good. That's interesting, man. Very interesting.
We demand examination.
We have a good
time. I won 3 in a row. It was absolutely insane.
Are you the only one?
No, I'm not the only one.
The only one who won three in a row?
Or? I don't think so. And also, it was not really 3 in a row I played. So, like, because I...
Not skipped. 3 in a row. 3 in a row that you played yourself. Okay.
Yeah. Still pretty good.
Yeah, no, that's... quite remarkable.
Were you playing a lot when you were a kid, or like when did you start playing?
I was playing quite a lot on ICC, basis. But I didn't have internet at home until I was 15 or 16.
Really? Wow.
Yes, my parents were like, it will distract you. In hindsight, they were probably right.
That's actually huge, because I remember having, and we're more or less the same age, you're in October 98, and I'm in January 91. And I remember growing up with internet and spending way too much time on Facebook chats and
AOS. Yeah, but Facebook chats, I mean, I already had internet at that moment, like, because Facebook, I mean, was created in 2004, but it became a thing in Europe in 2008, more or less. So, like, I got my Facebook account in 2008. So, and then I was wasting time. But I was already in uni, so, like, anyway, during... And I was studying math, but that also included computer lessons. So, like, I was always on a computer anyway, already.
Okay.
Most of my time was wasted on ICC.
ICC, yes.
So we played a lot on ICC.
We played a lot. Adaptation, yeah.
Yeah, and Leon Beast, yeah?
No, Mateus back then on ICC.
Mateus.
Yeah. Okay. I remember we played a lot of Bullet, which I think you were heavily the favorite in. And I don't know if remember if we played much Blitz.
By the end, I was playing mostly 1-0 and
3-0
pulls.
I think
it's a great stuff, the pulls. Yeah, it should be more like that on chess.com, I think.
I mean, you can go inside the waiting list or whatever.
But it's not the same because you can abort the games on chess.com.
The thing with the pool is that you're not expected to get a rematch. You just keep clicking for the pool, so you always get a different opponent.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is actually more fun than getting the same opponent for me personally.
Yeah, I think it was very, very intense. And it was just, I remember this 1-0 bullet pool. Like, Ikao was completely dominant. He had like high scores of 3,050 or maybe 3,100. And like I was close to second with 2850. But I remember that at first I was only playing with touchpad. So my touchpad was remarkably good for me to manage to get to 2820 maybe.
That sounds absolutely painful.
Yeah, but and I was like, I mean, I'm doing good. I don't see what the mouse will bring me. And then one time I bought a mouse, I started playing and I thought, oh, this is going to be much easier.
Yeah, I can't imagine playing on touchpad and bullet. It just seems impossible.
Or with that little scroll, red scroll on the IBM laptops.
I mean, you can also type the moves in, which I think is easier than touchpad at least.
Ah, you could do that on ICC. Yeah.
No, but some touchpads are impossible, but this specific touchpad was working out quite well. Like, it was not... I was not losing too much time, except with Kawu. When it comes to the final second there, this was not great.
Yeah. I want to talk about chess in France as well, and the support you're getting, the changes that occurred after Alireza joined the team as well. You guys always had, and this was at least from my perspective, a very cohesive team. Whenever you guys were participating, you guys were always having a good time,
yeah.
And also scoring very well. How is that team atmosphere?
Yeah, we are lacking a medal in an Olympiad, I think. This is the issue. We won a couple medals in the European Team Championship, but in Olympiad, I think our best result is 7. Like, sometimes we were actually quite close in Batumi. If we win the last match against Russia, we actually win gold, which is insane. Like, it wouldn't have been deserved. But
instead of China, yeah? China won gold finally, right? In Batumi.
Yes. I think we were the closest in Tromsø in 2014. We were, like, more or less in the lead with 2-1 to go. We played China. We lose a match we could easily have won, and then we play Russia as a reward in the last round.
That's bad luck. Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what about next year? Are you going to go with your strongest team?
I hope so. Like, I'm going. Like, if I'm selected, let's assume I am. Like, I think Alireza is also motivated, but you know, I cannot speak on his behalf.
Yeah. What happened in 2022? That was the first year where you and Alireza both could have participated.
Yeah.
For
me, what happened is I was just very, very scared of the weather conditions in Chennai. Yeah, I just saw Chennai in August. And like, the decision was given in May. Like, we took the final decision in May. And at that moment in Chennai, it was like 45 degrees, 45 to 50 degrees every day. I'm like, I cannot play a tournament in such conditions. And also because, of course, I enjoy playing for the French team, but I don't want to jeopardize my career. And like, a few days after, there was a Grand Chess Tour in St. Louis, and I had a lot at stake. Like, I needed to get into top three to qualify for the next year. Like, that's also issues because I've lost quite a decent amount of rating. So before that, like, I didn't need to care too much about getting qualified for tournaments. I would just get invited because of my rating. But
and finally, you did get second place in that Grand Chess Tour, right?
Third and second this year.
Wesley got second. And
I think
Alireza
so, yeah.
First. Okay.
So you got second this year as well, which qualifies you to do
yeah, I've
the
been
next year.
Remarkably consistent in Grand Chess Tour. I've had like 5 second places.
That's great.
Yeah, but never won.
Okay, yeah. Okay. That's interesting. And it's, how is your...
It's your first win in Grand Chess Tour, or maybe
yeah,
second?
Yes.
First win, yeah.
Your closest was in 2019. We already mentioned the tournament, right? When you were playing Ding in the final.
Yeah, but I got smashed by Ding. I think the closest was 2018, was my final match against Hikaru. This was much closer.
Oh, yeah, you got to the final twice, yeah? Against Hikaru and against Ding. Yeah, I remember this.
Yeah, you were playing. You played
I was playing.
Hikaru.
I lost Hikaru in the first. Yeah. I beat Levon for the relevant third
place. Yeah.
And you played Hikaru, yeah.
That was actually right after the match, 2018.
Yeah, right after the match.
You actually went back to the US and then came back like a week later.
Yeah, to the same place. It was a bit of a strange... I kind of wanted to play, but it was a bit of a strange journey back.
Yeah. Back and forth.
Didn't look at chess during that tournament.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. That match was very intense.
How's Alireza coming along within the French team?
Like when he played in 2021, it went extremely well. He was very comfortable. We made him at his. Like, I think now also he's getting more comfortable with French language. So the problem I have with Alireza is that for like the past 4 years, I've been speaking only in English with him. So it's very hard to switch back to another language, right? If you start speaking with someone in English and then you go back to French, it feels completely unnatural.
So in the team meetings with him, it's all French and he's doing his best.
We were doing in English in 2021, but next year I suppose we will do French.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. How important is the captain for the French team?
Captain is paramount. We've had Sébastien as our main captain for the past 10 years.
Yeah?
Sébastien Mazet.
Yeah.
And it's gone very well. Like, again, we're having a good time, but we are serious when it comes to, you know.
What's the role of the captain for your team? Because I know John Donaldson is paramount as well for the American team. It adds...
It's really about atmosphere and like... Because I noticed, for instance, when it came to the US team, especially in 2016, it felt like there were clans between the players and like... some players were simply not speaking to each other and felt bad because it is a team competition after all. And maybe, you know, it's an impression from the outside. Maybe it was not justified, but...
The U.S. relations
probably
are,
had some truth to it.
Yeah, they're always a bit complicated. I mean, so Hikaru was playing in 2016, Wesley, Shanklin,
yes.
Ray Robson,
and Ray. Yeah. That was the whole team, right?
That's when you guys won. Yeah, that's
and our captain players. And... our captain John Donaldson, but who was the coach?
Hess, right? Hess was.
Robert was not the coach of the women's team.
I'm pretty sure
he was.
Then Lenderman.
Ah, yeah, Alex Lenderman. Sorry, that's not that Alex. He was the coach. Yeah, the U.S. team. Yeah, it's always been complicated because I've never had like an issue with people, but there was definitely a time when I think Carter was not like. Not that we had unfriendly terms or anything, but I don't think that he was like super fond of me, and like Shanklin as well. So anyway, that's irrelevant.
Yeah.
But
French team, of course, we would play cards. We play table tennis.
Those are always the rumors.
We have a lot
you guys are having a good time all the time.
Yeah, we have all these side activities, but okay, when it comes down to actually playing the games, we know.
Do you guys
we need to focus, we need to...
Training camps before?
We did a few times, but not recently.
Because I think that adds a layer of...
Yeah, but the thing is, we know each other for like 10, 15 years, especially like we had this backbone, like we had Laurent, we had Etienne and me, were like those three players who were playing more or less all the time. Especially in Olympiads, and so this brings like already a solid, solid field to rely on. You have the captain, and like we've known each other for the past. I mean, Laurent and Etienne have known each other for the past 25 years. For me, maybe it's 15 years, but still, it's solid background. And then all the players, like all the new additions. Should it be Maxime? Should it be Jules? We also know them for a very long time.
Jules Moussard, Maxime Lagarde, and actually another player that's coming along, it's Maurizi, the new World Junior champion.
Yes, this is a player I know the least, but still, even then, I've seen him in some tournaments since he was 11, 12. Now he's, I think, 16. So, you know, still, it's quite easy to incorporate him in the team and so far, he managed very well when he played, I think he played two times for the team, maybe three even.
So with his rating, which board would he be currently?
His rating is like 25.
80 or so?
Yeah, something like that. He played in the Grand Swiss, actually.
Yeah, he did well. No, he started well.
He
then
started
he
very well, yeah,
he collapsed,
and he collapsed. Well, you know, when you're a young player, it can happen, yeah. But he, at least he showed he can do it. Like,
yeah, he has some promise for sure.
Yeah.
But the, so the team now would be that you would be on first board and Etienne on second board. Because Etienne is now having a resurgence, right?
Alireza.
Oh, sorry.
We're forgetting Alireza.
No, first board is first of all not easy to determine.
Yeah.
I think it will go on current shape. Like, we'll see how it goes beginning of 2024. Because if I do well, if Alireza does well, it's good, of course. And if one of us doesn't do well. Also, you can devise strategies, like you can get someone to board for to rack up the points. It could be. But of course, like against the top teams, anyways, there's no weak points.
Mm-hmm. But you would also want like the top guys on the first two boards.
Yeah, but
because your openings are a bit more fleshed out at the moment. Like let's say you and Alireza, Etienne is a little bit less of an active player and his openings might not be as secure against the top
guys. It's true, but for instance, Laurent, you might want him to be in a role of solid player looking for draws, like he's been doing that very successfully and sometimes winning games. So it really comes down to a lot of parameters. I think this will be one of the most difficult team composition we'll have to do if all the players.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a very good thing.
Those type of, and we do. We.
I do feel like we could have a very strong team, like because Alireza is at very average, mediocre year, but he's only 20. And I mean, I wouldn't rule him out at all. Like, I think it goes down to a few moments of, you know, turning points, and then he can roll back again towards 27-17, 27-80 easily.
What about you? You've had a pretty rough year also in classical chess. You're 33. How is your motivation right now? How are your motivation levels? Right
yeah,
now?
I've been talking about consistency and the lack of in the past few years. There have been few changes in my environment, coaching environment, and so on. And I do think I learned a lot in the past couple of years, and I do hope that some of these learnings will come to fruition. And my main axis of work will be to regain this consistency I've been sorely lacking in the last couple of years. Because I think, like, again, I've won really a lot of events in the past 3 years. Like, since COVID, I've won at least 4 or 5 events.
And this gives some confidence as well.
It means I can do well. Like, of course, and there's the AI Cup where I beat Magnus twice. So, you know, and Magnus in this format is like the most...
Very difficult to beat.
Yeah, the most difficult opponent you can have. So I know when I'm at my best, I can beat absolutely anyone. So, yeah, it gives confidence. But it also means that it shouldn't happen that I have these tournaments where I'm playing... not only average, because average can happen. It always happened to me to play average, but really below par. This shouldn't happen.
So what are your goals for the next year, or like the tournaments that you're really focusing on or looking forward to the most?
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting because there's no candidates qualification this year, so it's really gonna be down to Grand Chess Tour for me. Probably some rapid events because I do believe the trend is going for rapid. At the moment, classical is getting outshined, let's say. If we're talking numericals, I would hope to be back to top 10 in classical, between 5 and 10, let's say. I think better than top 5 will be difficult, but 5 to 10 would be good. And... yeah, I mean, Olympiads, of course, I'll be focusing on. So that's why I'm hoping we'll have the best team.
So wait, next year there's no candidates qualification?
There is candidates, basically.
No, I mean, there's candidates, yeah. And then there's a match.
2025.
Yeah.
The match rule is supposed to be next year as well?
Probably.
Yeah, and it was an issue for me in 2018 where I missed out on qualification to candidates, but like the thinnest of margins everywhere. That there was no candidates events, so I was lacking motivation because I had a very exhausting year in 2017. So 2018, I was just relying on basically my knowledge of 2017, and it worked out quite well. But then 2019 was tough.
Because you worked less during the last year.
Yeah, and then 2019 I was working a lot, but then the last few months were crazy. I played 5 out of the last 6 months, and all very important events.
The Grand Chess Tour that we mentioned.
But then there was the FIDE Grand Prix, there was the FIDE World Cup. I didn't play the Grand Prix because it was 1 week after the World Cup where I played this match for third place, which didn't make
any sense. But finally you did qualify for the Canada.
Yeah, well, it was insane, yeah.
Which I think people viewed as sort of like jest in a way, even though it was by the most unusual way, right?
Yeah.
But because you were very, very close in every possible format that you eventually got in.
Yeah, at least it was not like, I think I was first reserve in basically every other format, so it couldn't be like someone else
Was that considered the wild card at that point?
Kirill Alexenko was the wild card.
Who?
Kirill Alexenko.
Okay, Alexenko.
Yeah.
So the wild card was going to be Russian no matter what.
Right.
But the qualification to be a wild card, you had to be eligible, was that you had to get top three.
You got somewhere. It was not even about the rating already. Like
no, it wasn't that. So he got
Third in Grand Swiss.
So he got the wild card. And then you got in because Timur Rajabov pulled out of the event.
And I was first reserve by rating.
Yeah, so...
By rating, okay.
And,
so it was
and you were leading for most of the event. So how do you... thought this was always very interesting because this... You were leading, beating Nepo halfway through when they...
Yeah.
When they got it all halfway. Like, how do you view this this tournament, both parts, and also the decision to actually cut it in half?
The decision didn't shock me, because back then we had a lot of uncertainties. Like, it was clear it would be tough to even go back to France or for you to the US if we didn't stop the tournament. Like, clearly borders were simply closing. And I didn't even envision myself spending 2 months in Russia. So, you know, it was uncertain times. We didn't know the extent of COVID. We didn't know, when we first heard about COVID, like in January, like we were in Gibraltar, some guys were freaking out because there were some Chinese players playing there. I was like, okay, guys, relax. Well, then a few months later, I was not relaxing. Then I was maybe relaxing a bit more, but I mean, still COVID proved to be pretty serious. We had to do a lot of things to get it constricted a bit. It took some time. It took some reevaluation because, well, the death rate and so on, like it was not always certain of what it was going to be. So, I mean, the decision to stop the tournament is normal. I don't think it broke me. But it did help Nepo in hindsight. Like, of course, he was getting a bit under the weather. He had lost this critical game with me. If he had drawn it, then basically tournament would have been more or less over. Like, yeah, even though it's only 1 point, it's a lot. Because then I had 4 blacks left.
I feel like this was a very critical, for him, because he was definitely not in the right state of mind after this?
Definitely not.
And I don't know about your state of mind, but it must have been relatively positive.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was all positive. So I learned I was going to play. I was in vacations in the US in February. I come back, I'm on my flight from New York to Paris. I arrive, then I'm in the taxi, and I get this message from Emil Sutovsky, who tells me, well, it's not official yet, but you might get in. At first, I thought it meant that Ding was not going to make it because China had all these really big protective measures. But turns out it was not Ding. And like he confirmed to me the day after. So basically, I think I arrived on the 4th or 5th of March. So in the matter of 1 day, okay, I had warned Etienne, of course, my manager, and everybody to get the visas if it comes down to this, to check the flights, to know when I would arrive and so on. and what I would do in terms of preparation as well, because, well, this was not planned out and the tournament was starting 2 weeks later. And I thrive on urgency. Like, I don't think it's a good thing necessarily, but sometimes when it you need to put yourself in emergency mode, suddenly I was in, like, it was 6-7 hours of day of chess, and then going to get the visa, and then getting my flight, playing some training games. And also in terms of opening, it all turned out perfectly, because I had some holes, of course, but, you know, everything that we were looking at and ended up matching, and we had this. And then because Jan had played the French, we could spend the rest day looking at the French. It was not even the initial plan to play E4, but we had one rest day, so French was good
openings,
news.
Your openings went very, like, also against Grishuk in the Berlin endgame. I was kind of surprised because you had so little time to prepare, but then when you came there, like, you were pressure with white.
This was earlier, like, this was...
So you had some reserve ideas that were also...
Yeah, yeah. Well, on Berlin endgame especially, like, because back then I was the only one playing it with white, so of course I was out preparing a lot of players. Also because they were lacking the experience from the black side.
Because nobody plays against them.
Yeah. And then the second half, yeah, probably we had these moments, like in September, they were telling us it might resume in November and so on. Like, so it
at
was...
At first they told us Georgia.
Yeah.
Was that, like, they wanted us to go not to, like, a capital city in Georgia, but to some resort in the mountains.
Yeah.
In the middle of nowhere. It was some weird preliminary ideas. And, okay, finally they put us in the same place.
Yeah. Mm. And so it was like, yeah, very on and off. And in terms of preparation, it kind of disrupted me. I was still very serious, of course, about my chess. But yeah, it just didn't pan out. But, you know, it could definitely have, like, a few critical moments when it went wrong, of course, against you.
Yeah, I think this was a very important game.
Yeah, and I did everything right for a while until I didn't.
Yeah. Like,
and then this end game, I could have held it as well, like, but I could definitely have lost it, and I ended up losing it. And then I think the last draw was against Sasha, where we were going full-blooded fight. And at some point, I have more or less a guaranteed draw, but I'm still going for it because I know I need a win.
Oh, this was the knight c3, b3, d4 line.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
e4, c5, mm-hmm. knight c3, d6, d4.
D4. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this crazy game. Mm-hmm. I was like, didn't understand a single thing that was happening when you were playing.
I mean, I was actually pretty close to lost at some point, but then I came back. And at this moment, I started playing for a win and it didn't pan out. And then I won two games in the last three, but it was too late. Like, Jan had built it up his lead and he lost the last game. So it shows the margin, because I'm sure that if he needs to draw, he will be more focused for sure. Like, maybe he loses, but not in the way he did.
Yeah, the last game was for him not very relevant. That's true.
And also, Anish was ahead of me before the last game and he lost it.
To Grishuk?
No, to Kirill.
Wait, when did he lose to Grishuk? Oh, that wasn't the last, that was the before the last game.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Against Kirill, it was this four-knight Sicilian with e6, which is very topical now. And I think Anish played a3 and got outplayed more or less.
I mean, I lost against Anish playing a3 in four-knight Sicilian. Are you mixing up these games? Against Kirill? I mean...
I'm pretty sure I'm not, but... I mean... Because I know your game against Anish, but it was very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't remember his game. I remember Kirill's game against you, where he lost, like, within 10 moves in the Karakhan.
Yeah, and I actually fought on, like, became very close to a draw.
But I thought, like, at the end of his tournament, it was just getting a bit random. Like,
and we had Wangawa, who was, like, we didn't know what he was, why he was playing there.
Yeah, he just didn't want
to
be there.
Well, like, the good thing is, like, after that, he was broken, but he got back to spirits later on.
You mean after the tournament?
after the tournament, he just retired from chess. Like
he
in front of me.
During the tournament, he was
But I'm saying, like 1-2 years later, he.
Ah, okay.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Slowly coming back, I guess.
He did play Norway chess. He played some other events. He felt happy. So, like at the end of the day, that's the most important, right?
Yeah. Where did I see him recently? He played something recently, right?
I cannot remember. Now, I do want to touch on this point before we move on, because we've been talking openings and preparation. Conceptually, you're a very interesting player, because with black pieces, you play the Nydorf, the Grünfeld, and then occasionally you dabble in other stuff, but mostly the Nydorf and the Grünfeld.
It has evolved a bit lately, but yes.
How did you develop that strategy, I guess, and how did you decide to stick with it? Because
it was as a young player, I just felt very comfortable in both openings, but things changed gradually, especially in the Grünfeld. I remember in 2007-2008, I was just playing some very random line. I think Bishop C4 Knight E2 line was very topical at the time. I was playing some random line with Bishop D7, and I was winning all my games simply with it. So, you know, I was getting worse position, but I felt like I was handling them better. It was the same with Nydorf. I would often get out prepared, notably by this guy to my left. And
we had a period before when you were beating me in Nydorf.
But you were out preparing me, and then I would just be more comfortable and just navigate the complications better. And like same against Anish, there was one very big game in Norway chess.
This is a
bishop g5 line.
Yeah, this is famous.
Where he wanted to sack the queen, but I didn't let him. I played something that loses by force, but he didn't punish.
Yeah, he basically, like the first move out of his prep, went from winning to losing, right?
To worse.
But it was, to be fair, a very complicated position.
It was very complicated. And he knew it, and he sat for 40 minutes, but it didn't matter. But now I think the computers being what they are, you cannot get out of your opponent's preparation. Like if you play the force move of the computer, will still be very much in your opponent's comfort zone. So, and they know the plans better. And the computers don't make mistakes now. Back even in 2016, they were making mistakes.
They can prepare deeper, faster also.
And
faster. They can cover much more ground much faster nowadays.
Yes, and pick some subline and sometimes pick some main lines. So that means that I had to, out of necessity, and also because the main lines changed, which means that especially in Grünfeld, my comfort zone was not the same in some lines than in the main ones back 15 years ago. Already 10 years ago, it had changed. And I mean, I do remember I had these experiences in 2013 World Cup. I didn't feel like playing Nydorf and Grünfeld. I ended up playing Caro-Kann and Slav. Not only you.
Which actually worked.
It worked. I ended up in semifinals, my first semifinals in World Cup. And I lost to Vladimir. But
Vladimir Kremnik. Yes. Who won it finally?
Yes. Like I saw him at the airport before in Paris, because he was still living in Paris, I think, at the time. And he said, yeah, I'm just going to get my qualification by waiting. I'm a tourist there. You won't see me next week.
Wow. Yeah. No, he did amazing. He beat Andre Kitten very convincingly in the final.
Yeah, yeah. And against me, it was very convincing. Cause
very impressive.
Like in the tie breaks, I was actually doing very well. And against him, I didn't have a chance.
I think people, now that he's retired, do forget a little bit about how strong he was. How incredibly strong. He got third in.
No, the problem is we get the instant time judgment.
This is the issue now, that basically people's attention span in chess is really like the last week, maybe even the last game.
Yeah, maybe let's say the last 3 months, but you don't think about what a player has achieved over the past few years or. And like when we talk about Vladimir over the past 20, 25 years.
I don't think it's only in chess.
It's not only in chess.
I think it's
a social media thing, I think. Because you get so much more attention on what is currently happening. And you don't get to have time to ponder over it.
This week's news cycle, basically.
And it's not something I enjoy so much. Like, I think there should be time to reflect on things. Should it be your chess? Should it be on the current news? And to just let it grow on you, let you think about it, to let you think about what it means, to let you think about what you should do to, because long term is still like much better than very short term. Like you want to do something that is right for you in the long term, not.
Speaking of this long term time frames that you're very much pointing out, you're also one of the few top players that finished a degree. You have a
correct
math degree. When did you finish that? At what age did
2010.
You finish that?
We were talking about that with Fabi. I said my memories of my math studies are fading very much now. I was 20.
20 when you finished it?
Yeah.
So you started very early on.
17. Yeah?
17. Wow. Yeah. Precocious. Very precocious.
Yes. There's been a lot of mathematics talk in the chess world.
Yes.
We don't have to get into that.
That's
yeah.
a good segue.
No, I'll just say this. When it comes to statistics, I wouldn't touch them with a pole because it's so difficult. And like, it's not even that it's really difficult. It's just so easy to make mistakes because of some implied things that you forget. So yeah, I would leave that to seasoned mathematicians. And I think even they make mistakes sometimes.
I think even, like, I started to think about it, not to get too deep into the subject, but maybe it's not helpful at all. Like, maybe statisticians also won't help. Chess players can't do it, clearly. Statisticians probably won't be able to apply statistics to these things because I don't even know. Because, yeah, as you said, it's based on some implied things which we can't even figure out. I think Rishik said the same thing. It's like, it's based on how likely is a person to actually cheat. And yeah. This is based on their character, right? It's like, well, how are we going to possibly calculate this?
No, but there are also, like, very famous things that were happening back in 1950, 1960, some results that mathematicians didn't understand. And when they got to the root of it, they understood, but it was, like, not obvious at all. I don't remember the exact details, but like there are some very famous.
There's this very famous one. I mean, you probably know the Monty Hall.
But this is kind of easy. You have three doors, yeah?
Yeah, but this, like, I don't know which year it was, but there was this woman who's probably still alive, Marilyn Vos Savant.
Yeah.
And she was, like, writing a column in some newspaper, which I don't remember, where people would ask questions and she would answer them, and someone pose this question, like you have three doors, behind two is nothing or whatever, like a goat, and behind one is like a lot of money, and there's a game show host that says pick a door. So you pick a door, and then before the game show host opens his door, the game show host, who knows where everything is, opens another door, not the one that you picked. And behind it is nothing, and says, okay, now would you like me to open the door you picked, or do you want to change your choice? And so this was the question posed, and she answered that, yeah, of course you should change your door. And then every mathematician in the world, I'm exaggerating, but like hundreds of mathematicians were like, what kind of idiot are you? Like, obviously, I mean, it doesn't change your chances.
It doesn't change anything, yeah.
But it does.
It does. And it becomes obvious if you do it not with three doors, but with 100. Like, you have one car and 99 goats, let's say. So you remove 98 doors that are goats. And now you definitely want to change the door because you get so much more information.
Yeah it's based on, maybe it's like a misunderstanding.
No, it's based on the fact that basically, if you choose the right door to begin with, then you lose. But if you choose the wrong door to begin with, then by changing, you win. So you get two chances out of three instead of one out of three. If you go to 100 doors, then the chance you pick the right door is one out of 100. And then if you do the change while you had the car to begin with, you lose. But in the other 99 cases, you choose a goat, then 98 goats get removed, but it doesn't matter because, you know, by changing, you will get the car. So that's that.
How would you say going through university, going through that experience changed your perspective of everything, including
chess? I think it was very good for me because, first of all, I didn't want to be fully immersed into the chess world, being only talking with chess people. Not that it's great, but you get certain perspectives when you go out in other areas, and I think it did change me a bit. And I didn't want to focus like 6-7 hours of chess every day. This I didn't want to do at the time. I probably still don't want to do, like, not every day at least. So yeah. And I enjoy math. Like, I definitely, like, will turn math into a hobby once I'm retired.
You like it? You enjoy
it?
Yeah. Did it make your decision to pursue chess as a career easier or harder?
I think by the end of my 3 years licence, as we call it in French, I was pretty sure I would go into chess, try my luck. I had done 2700, I just won the World Junior Championship. You know, I mean, if I'm not trying it out, then we will, like, so...
Which junior championship are you talking about? Are you talking about 2010 Argentina?
2009, but yes, Argentina.
2009, that was Argentina, right?
Yeah.
I was there as well.
Yeah.
Probably the most fun event I've ever had, actually.
Yeah, I ended up sharing a room with two other French players. I mean, with the coach and with the other French guy who was playing. That was a bit insane, but it worked out in the end.
Yeah, I remember Yu Yang.
And the coach was
there.
Famously Arnaud Char. So
yeah. Maybe our viewers don't know who that is, but we have no idea. You don't know who Char is?
I don't think so.
Oh,
well,
this is the great
2010 Olympiads Ranty-Mansisk.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So he was the captain. Coach, yeah?
Yes.
He's the captain.
He was my coach, yeah.
He was feeding them the moves, right?
Well, it was
the
three
the
people.
Project.
Yeah. The player, Feller, the captain,
and somebody back
and
home.
Marzolo.
Yes.
Yeah. And who was giving the moves to Hachard, and they had some system where you stand behind a chair and it means
something. I mean, we actually don't have confirmation of that. Like, we just know basically the text were being sent in. Someone was receiving them, probably Arnaud. Could also be Ferrer as well.
Mm. Oh, you think he could have gotten it directly? Huh?
It's not impossible. But, like, of course, rules were... Like, at least some things changed. I don't think enough things changed in the chess world after that. But back then, it was possible basically to bring your phone to the playing hall, which is
yeah.
Insane.
Did you feel something is wrong during the
I didn't. And also, before the last round, because the moment they realized, the French president of federation realized something was going on, I won't get into the details. It was by pure accident. They just went over the text message that were being sent through Marzolo. So they realized this before the last round, we had the worst day before the last round. And then Arnaud told the team that Sébastien was feeling ill and was not going to play the last round. And we're like, he's our best... He's our top scorer. If we win the match, we get third place, probably. I mean, let him play, yeah? What is it, like, is he dying or something? No, he's not dying. Let him play. And, final decision was made that he doesn't play. Okay, we were a bit shocked. Then 3 months later, the Federation started talking to us because they didn't know how to handle this. Like, first of all, they didn't want to make it public while in Russia. They were very scared for... Very concerned for actually their
safety. Yeah,
yeah, their safety there. So they decided to ponder things over in France, and that's when they were like the players fought back. So they decided to actually claim they were not cheating and just threaten to sue. So.
And sounds, then, sounds familiar.
No, yeah, but also, I mean, the legal proceedings lasted for almost 10 years. And there were some very, very unpleasant complications. For me, for instance, I got my luggage stolen in one of the tournaments.
Yeah, I remember that story. Actually.
Because you were a witness.
I was a witness. And it was right at the end of the French Championship. And then the very next day, I was going to the World Cup.
And that's the moment when you lost your luggage.
Yeah, well, lost. No, I mean, basically, the information we got from the police is that one particular person got the, you know, all-inclusive hotel pass, so like from the reception, because they claimed they had lost their key, and the way it was working is they gave a key that could open all the doors.
That sounds very sketchy.
Yeah.
France, good security.
Well.
Very sketchy.
I don't
How
think
does that work? Where do you get this full-on package?
Yeah, and then this door was this key was tested to open one door and then mine. So we know more or less. We know more or less who were the people involved in that. But yeah, then.
Did you receive any threats?
No, like time, so. Then I just like, of course, I was motivated first. But it lasted 6 months, 1 year, and I didn't receive answers. And like my play was deteriorating at a very rapid state. So I just thought, okay, like I'll let it go. Because it's getting complicated, and I'll just focus on my chess, and it worked out in the end.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's more or less it. We've covered a lot of ground. We even talked about cheating in the past, cheating in the present. We didn't really touch too much on it.
Yeah, I think that's good.
Do you want to say anything about it, or like?
No, I mean, in general, I don't think it should be about any particular players. I've covered this subject on Twitter, notably. Like, I think we want chess to become chess tournaments to become a safe space for players, because not only do you do not want to have cheaters at your events, but also you do not want people who perform well to be immediately accused of cheating.
Oh,
and it happened very recently.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And
you don't want people to be paranoid that they might be the subject of suspicion just because they're having good results.
Yes.
As well.
And you do not want people to be paranoid because they think their opponent might be cheating. So, like, for instance, when in the World Cup there was no broadcast delay, I thought it was insane. I mean, it's not like the one measure that will solve our problems, but it's one of the many that we need.
Yeah. So broadcast delay, that's one of the things that
I think right now we cannot allow spectators in events anymore. Like in the World Cup, there were spectators involved a lot. I don't think that's really possible. Not in the playing hall, at least.
Yeah, they should have a spectator zone with TVs.
Yeah.
But that's going to be very tricky. I mean, take Grand Chess Tour, for example. During Poland, during Warsaw, you will always have, especially Rapid and Blitz, you will play in this like big theater with a bunch of spectators.
They could do it so that it's blacked out, though.
Yeah.
Somehow.
I think
that has to be the case, but
there are some possibilities, and like they would get the interaction anyway at the end of the game, and they could have a spectator zone. Like it's possible to devise something out.
I don't think it's so difficult. Like if you have, for example, Poland, we have basically a stage.
Yes.
Like a theater stage.
Theater stage, yeah.
So the lights shine on the theater stage.
Yes.
Everything else is black. There's no way to see what's in the audience. It's like a movie theater.
Right.
Yeah.
They could see the stage, but you can't see in the audience for
right.
sure. It can be pitch black or it can be close to it.
Maybe
not
that's
very difficult.
Maybe implement. That's a bad example.
Yeah.
But for example, in India, yeah, at the Olympiad, I've heard there were a lot of spectators.
Okay, I don't think that what happened during Olympiad in India should actually happen. I think that it was just very bad. I don't know if they could have made it better. I mean, I think they did their best, but the conditions were actually almost unplayable.
Yeah, when I played in India this year, they had volunteers to actually separate the court from the players. Like, they were forming a human chain, and we could navigate through it.
Yeah, this shouldn't happen. Also, like...
But this was working decently, that's what I mean. Like,
yeah, but still, this shouldn't be the...
Yeah, I guess.
But I mean, during the Olympiad, like, I could not pretty much go to
the
games.
Also, the anti-cheating measures at this tournament in India were non-existent, so... Yeah,
that's what we're talking about.
So
right
I think
now, right?
Organizers should take this much more seriously. Like, at least with Grand Chess Tour, they have been taking that into account. And of course, here, I think this is the safest I felt.
Here, I think here on the Grand Chess Tour is more or less the same measures. Like, they have the same scanner.
Well, especially in the single cup. You're talking about the branches were
in Singfield Cup. Yes.
All the St. Louis events have the same measures.
Yeah, but for instance, in Europe, I don't think we have the same scanners.
They need to invest in these scanners. I mean, they're expensive, but they're a good investment.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, $20,000 I think for a scanner.
Yeah.
Okay, it's expensive, but it's a good investment.
Yeah.
It's a tax.
And also, it can work for all the events in Europe, so it's possible to.
Yeah, I know that they had this for the World Cup, but they had non-linear junction scanners, which if something conducts electricity, an electrical signal, then it detects that.
Yeah.
That's basically.
I mean, that's what I've been told. But
yeah, I don't know the details of it, but that's what it was.
So yeah, a combination of many things might at least make chess safer. And that's over the board. Online, I think it's pretty much impossible to guarantee, barring a very, very powerful algorithm that will detect any cheating, but I don't think...
If that could develop at some point.
Yeah.
No, I think they just need to mitigate, so just make it as difficult as possible. Cameras.
Yeah. And but I do think that it's preferable to have hybrid types of tournaments where you have to go to a location or you need to have an arbiter present at your home. But of course, it requires extra costs. So.
Actually, tell me, so just specifically about technology for online events, 360 cameras do exist, right?
But I mean...
They do, yes.
So, but I mean, as long as you're not being checked by someone, you can just have a earpiece.
Yes.
Okay, that you can't do anything about.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's simply the easiest. You can have something in your shoe.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just talking about mitigation, preventing the...
Yeah, but when people decide to devise a system, you cannot actually do really anything. Yeah.
You have to involve algorithms at that point.
Algorithm or physical presence. That's why.
But you cannot have physical presence with.
It's difficult.
If you combine players, you can.
So yeah.
They would have to set up a location where players play.
And I mean, I do understand it requires a very costly investment. So, it's not something probably that chess.com doesn't want to do if they don't feel it's absolutely necessary, basically. Because it's probably, we're talking millions probably.
Or just difficult for the players. Let's imagine
also difficult for the players.
And you have centralized locations where they have an arbiter. Okay, the arbiter is not going to.
But then it's very difficult for the players.
Yeah.
Because you probably have one location in Europe, maybe two in the US.
Something like this.
Yeah.
So players have to travel. Some will have to travel.
And maybe two in Asia. Yeah, it's
very difficult.
Yeah, because sometimes players were also playing these tournaments while playing their own tournament.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the thing. Big investments from the organizer's perspective, but also from the player's perspective, which probably will limit.
But at the same time, when you think about every other esport, they're playing these events from physical locations. So I think a good step in this direction is that we don't have 6 events for the Champion Chess Tour next year, but 4. So it's better to do less of them, but do them well.
But then you're going to limit participation. You're not going to have the same numbers of players.
I know.
I played in this plane.
Not every solution is ideal, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about choices. And of course, again, cheating is very rampant. Yeah, I mean, we've had our own estimations of online cheating in Title Tuesdays. It's... Basically, and for me, when it comes to let's say the top 50, top 100 players, regulars in Title Tuesday, I would say that's really 30%, which is a lot.
You believe 30% of the top 100 players in the world or top 100 players in Title Tuesday?
In Title Tuesday.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah. And that's online. And then over the board, again, I might be on the... upper side of paranoia, I don't know, but I do think there are some ungodly things happening. Sometimes, yeah. And also, it's a very difficult subject over the board because there's been very natural improvement because people have access to better hardware, to better software, to better information. And especially since COVID, they worked a lot more. So there's been natural improvement for a lot of players. But some things also do not feel very right. Yeah, so but it's just a feeling. I mean, I don't have time to do statistics or whatever to to back things up. And again, even with statistics, I would use more than a grain of salt.
Well, Maxime, if we don't cut it off right now, you're probably going to miss your flight. So
yeah,
we're gonna let you go. Thanks.
It was a pleasure being here.
Joining us
for this.
Yeah, I wanted to be on the pod, so it's a good thing it happened.
We've made it happen.
Yeah.
Well, great having you, and have a safe flight.
Yeah. Thank you.